Hello. Yes, I'm here. I can see the chat room clearly. And you have a question. Forgive me straight out. I don't know how to answer questions. In that, there's no preconceived knowledge or understanding of any kind resonating here. This is improvisational. If our improvisation bears a fruit of some kind, well, yay. So, sure. And feel free to type it in small chunks if it's needs more fleshing out. Okay. Song. Lyrics. I hope it has a beat and you can dance to it. Yes. Cats in the Cradle. Harry Chapin. Cats in the Cradle and the Silver Spoon, Little Boy Blue and the Man in the Moon. When you coming home, Dad? I don't know when, but we'll get together then. Son, we'll have a good time then. Yes, Fiji's. Both of those songs are a clear indication of deep enlightenment. Yes. Hi, Sai. Glad you could join us. Good. The songs or the lyrics or their repetition brought you some clarity. Yes. Clarity, if I may. Clarity about what? That's a good sign, of course. Anything that slaps us silly is a friend indeed. Well, you're not alone. You're not alone with that accusation. Blind and dumb, is consciousness's best act. Right, the conceiving, objectifying, fetishizing mind—that's that exudes authority and insistence on what it imagines it has found. I could call that certainly blind and dumb. Ah, okay. From blind and dumb to love. Why not? What a great segue. Oh, yeah. Love is, of course, an evocative, wonderful, and disorienting phrase, because it can be used in so many ways. Yes, of course, you know, as affection, as procreation, fondness, sensation. Uh-huh. So when you say it has quite a hold, something is present, not just the song or the lyrics to the song, or even the implication that the song or the message is gifting you with. Uh-huh. Hypnosis. Uh-huh. The song is a hint, of course. All right, so what is it that has a hold? Hypnosis has a hold? We're just teasing it out, right? So we can be kind of, clear and creative, you know, as we play with it, look at it. Oh, schmear, right? The whole schmear. Okay, I'm prepared to expound on demand. Why the fuck not? Well, it might be useful to create a line in the sand, and one that we can certainly cross over. On the one hand is the presence of experience. I know these things get a little silly, so you have to kind of tease them out a little bit. So what does the presence of experience suggest? Sentient vitality, sentient viability, aliveness, the movement or capacity of perception, the objects, which includes sensations and thoughts and everything pouring in through the sense plenums, the sense windows that suggest or imply objects appearing in perception. And then, of course, the emotive and or somatic and narration that accompanies presence and engagement or consideration, you know, whether toying around with a spiritual discovery or just being a basic secular Joe. And you could even drill down a little deeper you know, behind that which appears, the nature of its appearing, to whom or to what it's appearing, can also be considered, right? Contemplated upon. Now, it could be useful from a meditative bias or point of view to, what would you call it? Settle in, settle down, chill the fuck out, so that one is, you could say, resting or abiding, you know, without being too serious about it. Abiding, resting, chilling out in a receptive manner. So receptive means avoiding conclusion. Being willing just to sense, being willing just to feel, to notice the movement and the texture of sensing and feeling, which of course may include, you know, what arises in thought, you know, as a question, as an impulse, as a conclusion, as a consideration, as something that is agreeable or disagreeable, you know, then the emotional or physical response to the presence of abiding, the presence of discovery, the presence of inquiring. Now, as our attention shifts from assertion or agreement or disagreement or dismissal of any kind, then our attention actually takes notice of the qualities of non-directed attention. The availability, which is non-directed attention, not destination oriented, it's not problem solving oriented, there's no justification. So attention senses the quality of availability, curiosity, sensing, presence. And with a some, you could say, familiarity, you could use the word practice, of course, by discovering how it feels for attention to attend to itself or attend to availability, then the push and pull of objects or philosophies, cosmologies, what's right and wrong with the world and my ideas of the world, these tendencies, distracting, you could say, tendencies, might become quiescent. So one's ongoing attention is nourished through the simplicity, non-directed tension, uncluttered tension, and there can be an easefulness or a relaxation from the inertia to grapple with thought stream, to grapple with narration, or to grapple with ideas. Hi. Come on in. How's it going? Good to see you. I'm chatting with some friends online. Pull up a chair and we'll talk some. Okay, yeah, I'm hearing you. We personify very quickly. Through memory and mind and sensation and emotion, relationship and all that entails, we personify very, very quickly. And we may have strong impulses, you know, as concerns present relationships or prior relationships, or the pursuit of future relationships. And what do they say? All is fair in love and war. So if those impulses are present, impulses to communicate, for emotional intimacy, for perhaps, you know, validation or the expression of affection, for frustration, well, have at it. You know, make the phone call, send the email, text, and fax. Well, there's a lot to be said for what can we say? Simply suffering. Yeah. Sure, when there's affliction, emotional affliction, circumstantial affliction, we want to be healed of it. We want it to be removed, or expressed, or ameliorated, justified, perhaps. It's an exaggeration. It's an exaggeration of basic existential confusion. Yes, the nature of personification and our familiarity and clinging to it, our defense of it and justification, it can certainly be seen as an addiction. Well, I'll leave our good friends on the internet to discuss things amongst themselves.
Okay.
Everything you were saying was just, I just needed to hear, not for any particular reason. Yeah, just fell into place. That's right. What the heck? What the point? That's right. Send it, and then wish you wouldn't. Go ahead. Send it, and then be in anguish for days upon end because you said it.
Sure.
I
don't even know what they're talking about.
Yeah, well, yeah, we all know how that feels, whatever the strain might be.
Yeah. I'm going to send it, or not send it, anguish the day, or not.
Yeah. That's what we have. You know, life on earth as the person has anguish in equal measure.
With?
Whatever else you think you can find.
Oh, anguish in equal measure with pleasure?
Sure. Or, I mean, everything is in, you know, equal measure, whatever you find.
In equal measure against just the opposite of whatever you find?
Yes. I mean,
if you find pleasure, you're going to find 50%.
You can break it. You can break it down by percentages, as if life were a pie chart.
Oh, you might. You don't mean equal, like 50%. You just mean whatever you get, you're going to get the opposite.
I mean, here we are. This is what you get. Right. Yeah.
But come in tonight. Oh my gosh, I'm here.
That's right. Yeah. Let's say I'm considering or measuring somehow the quality of my life, you know, whether over a, you know, a span or today or this hour or whatever. You know, any attempt to, right, place a measure on things has to include accusation, belief, conclusion, the way things are, and then my reaction to that narration, that sense of being, whether I'm enjoying myself or I'm threatened or I'm having emotional, you know, angst of one kind or another. And then, you know, one's identity is in motion. We're on a tear. We feed, understandably so, no criticism intended, we feed the drama field of our own sense of entitlement, our own sense of self. Now, we may think we're doing it in many respects very practically, like if you're raising young children. You know, you have to be heavy-handed from time to time to protect them from dangers they may not understand. So, you know, in that way, we put our good sense to practical use. But a lot of the time, we put our powers of imagination, powers of demand, of need, want, and the frustration that accompanies all that, well, we don't put it to very good use. We might internalize or externalize, or both. And then, you know, we're living in the drama field that is me with respect to everything. My health, my family, who I'm with, who I'm not with, what I'm doing, what I'm not doing, how much I love or hate my job, whether I have or don't have enough money. I mean, it's endless. It's an incredible stream of imaginative power, imaginative creation. And then, you know, we'll go to therapy or gurus or diets or drugs of one kind or another to attempt to ameliorate the disquietude and the discomfort of being drunk on the imagination of ourselves. Now, it's obviously too easy to generalize when saying anything about anything. I mean, there are many, let's say, people that are suffering from malnutrition, violence in the home, you know, climactic disruption, sexual assault, et cetera, et cetera. And certain kinds of help and intervention could be very valuable. All right. Well,
you never know what you're
going to
make
up. Yes, but I mean, yeah.
There's no need to eat. Let's just bypass that.
Right. So, you know, to make this kind of a conversation a little more relevant, let's say, to place it into a utilitarian context, we hopefully want to start from a more mature, perhaps more relaxed, more adult launching place, so that we can really divine and divinize. What's that called when you have a stick and you're looking for water?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You want to use these powers of discovery to look into the nature of consciousness, into the nature of experience, to the nature of mind, the nature of sensation.
But so if you look too hard, it's like a mirage. Don't look too hard.
Yes.
Or it's there, but if you look too hard, and then it's gone. I'm saying you don't have to really look that hard.
As you get good at it, yeah. As you get a little more practiced with it, yeah, you learn how to dial in the right amount of energy, the right amount of effort, the correct quality of passion and dispassion. Yeah. Looking too hard could be a sign of, emotional bias. Looking too lightly could be another sign of emotional bias. So we benefit from a certain kind of easeful neutrality. If I'm dealing with strong emotional or circumstantial material, well, then, you know, that understandably fills the space. So it's very difficult to be, you know, easeful, neutral, affectionate in looking, because I have the pressure of circumstances and events that are, you know, threatening me, that require some degree of solution or attention. Yeah, we don't want to encourage, dissociation as a remedy for, you know, life's tribulations. But to be able to conduct a certain kind of consideration, yeah, we have to be capable and or willing for psycho-emotional material, circumstantial material, to, at least for a short time, be put aside. Otherwise, we are drafting, like as in behind, drafting our own hallucination, because we're driven by, you know, remedy. Revenge.
Just the physical proximity of a being.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like just move away for just a minute.
Uh-huh.
Just give me a minute.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what this is right now for me.
Good.
This is.
Right. Yeah. To carve out some time for yourself, some space for yourself to be at ease and not distracted or interactive. No demand is placed upon you. So, yes. There's the neuroticism of the culture. Is exacerbated by, you know, this unrelenting psychic pressure, whether it's political issues or financial issues, of all kinds. And as we are overwhelmed by too much information, too much demand on our attention, we become exhausted, psychically exhausted, and unable to nourish ourselves with doing nothing, with simplicity.
Right. Ability to multitask is no longer there. Oh, wait a minute. I just realized, not now, just realized.
Mm-hmm.
There was no ever such thing as multitasking.
Right. Right. Yeah, before they brought it up, I had no idea.
Yes. Oh, I was really good at working that thought. Geez, all those years, guess what? Room has different feel to it as opposed to when I came to see that other guy, the guy that sits with his legs crossed and stands up.
Adam?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Chaxfield, yeah.
Yeah, he was here. I think I had said to you, like,
horror
films, like, don't do it to the big now. It's just so nice.
Yeah.
Calm and peaceful.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, you don't want too much Jesus energy to mess things up. Well, I'm let you guys talk as you will. If you want to draw me in to it, I'm happy to dive in. I just looked like you were taking care of each other. You know, a problem-solving mind is an afflicted mind. The mind is also suggesting a persona, right? A vector, an agenda that is, you know, seeking pleasure or avoiding pain. Is an afflicted mind. It's a sense of identity, the burden of identity in psychological time. And this is exhausting. The burden of personification, the burden of identity in psychological time being full to overflowing with opinions and strategies and conclusions and defenses and compensations, knowledge, is a hell realm.
Especially when everybody's mind wants to be right.
And of course, everyone's mind wants to be right. Any Facebook page, any chat room, any, you know, weird, you know, this anonymous, right, way of relating to strangers through, right, not unaccountable written word, degrades into abuse.
I'm unfamiliar with that because uh-huh. I don't have Facebook, I don't have social media, I don't listen to Twitter. Or
good for you. Yeah.
The other ones, Twitter and.
Well, yeah, dozens, hundreds.
None of it.
Right.
Even just coming home and turning the TV on for 5 seconds.
Yeah.
It's literally 5 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's off.
Yeah.
It's just.
Yes. Yes.
So I can't imagine. I don't want to say the level of distress that humanity is allowing themselves to be sucked in.
Well, I think it's a fair observation. The manipulation of opinion, the hate speech that pours out of the media, is heartbreaking.
I wonder why do people get on Facebook and do this stuff and read it and then That's a rhetorical question.
Yes.
Because if you knew, you'd have your shingle out front. But
not me.
You think people would have had enough? Just
yeah.
So nice to have another being in the room without the overwhelming need to think that you have to fill in when there's silence.
Oh, you know,
it's just, this is so.
Yeah.
I mean, talk all you want, but what I'm
right.
just saying is.
No, I can watch the chat room. Yeah, there's no audio.
Oh.
One-way audio.
So all the written word.
Yeah.
They're all writing stuff.
Yeah.
Can they hear you?
Yes. Yeah, they can hear us. I'm not. You're a little quiet, but they can hear us. I'm sure. It's it's not. A common commonly cultivated in contemporary Western society for beings, humans, to enjoy each other's company without the pressure of having to validate or justify or, yeah, conclude anything. You know, in meditation halls, if you find a good one, there's a certain sweetness that can be present. But even then, sometimes there's, you know, ritualistic pressure, recitation pressure. It's a different quality of meditation when there's no liturgy. All right, well, let's play around with that for a little while. I'm in the grips of, an experience. Yeah. Well, not to be a horse's ass, but to be a horse's ass. Same level of habit or addiction or familiarity, behaviorally and otherwise, has always been present, not just with you and your 45-year-long relationship, but with any of us. So we're somewhat conveniently looking at the shock of a breakup, the shock of a cessation in a long, long standing relationship with more experience than anyone, you know, has room for. And then the recoil from the shock of the loss of the continuity of that relationship as being, you know, a particular event. But we don't see that even during the entire course of the relationship or the course of our lives, the, you know, the snake oil of of personification has always been present. In the naive, call it, you know, lustful parts of the relationship early on, and in the maturing processes of work, of home ownership, of raising children, you know, of the magnificent stage play that life presents us with, even during all that, the personification is present, right? Ideation is present, and negotiating with another human being and with oneself and with one's you know, emotional capacities or codependent capacities is present the whole time, but we don't necessarily look at those while the relationship is going on and say, what am I doing? We habituate to it, and why shouldn't we? So it only becomes, you know, a kind of a big shockwave if the relationship, when a relationship is, let's say, suddenly, perhaps without warning, severed. And now this whole inertia field, which was the imagination of myself and my memory and my behaviors and my love and my disappointments and frustrations, now they become you know, much, much larger in my imagination, triggered by the ending of the relationship. But it's not quite an accurate way to recapitulate. sensations arise and memories arise, like and dislike arises, change in rhythm, change in physical location. Yeah, these are for sure, you know, shock waves in the psyche. And yeah, they do seem to require a high standard of self-care to cope with, to navigate. And it hurts. Maybe it's just that simple. What I might find in present experience is hurting, loss, shame, rejection. Anger, fear, retribution. Threat to self. It may not be that useful to simply accuse myself of telling stories, as if once I can consent to that, I should feel differently. Absolutely. The strength of these ways of being, rhythms of being, and the disruption of these ways of being and the response to it is not just mental or emotional or narrative. It's absolutely somatic and has the same formidability as any substance addiction. Maybe one thing we can do, you know, in the midst of this kind of grief, is just let it hurt. You can't talk your way out of it. You can't talk your way into it. We don't have any control over it. Even if we're skilled Advaitins, skilled Dzogchen practitioners, it don't mean fuck all. We hurt. Grief hurts. Abandonment hurts. Betrayal hurts. Jealousy hurts. Hurts a lot. And even more than that. Well, gotcha. Anger is a little easier to deal with than sad. Maybe. I think you're right. Everything is a hint that there are no hints. It's not like there's some destination or condition or event. Or that what appears is a hint, but that it has some meaning. You know, or that there's an elusive revelation that you haven't put your finger on yet. Mind extrudes presence. Inputs and outputs, symptoms and implication. Why is something so? What is its meaning? What is it trying to tell me? What could, should I do differently or better? So, I mean, these are either lovely or maddening. But they're movements in mind. They're movements in, the generous fantasy of personification. They're occult. As long as we're anthropomorphizing what appears as present experience, then we're extruding, right? We're agreeing, if you will, to be time-bound. To be influenced by the presentation and implication of things. And as long as we are influenced by the presentation, personification, and implication of things, there's going to be distortion. And with that distortion, all manner of suffering. So the art of the yoga, since we can call it that, the art of the yoga is this presence uninfluenced. No conclusions, no strategies, no explanations. Permit yourself, give yourself the gift, give yourself permission to be uninfluenced, not be the product of experience, not be the product of accoutrement. That's the gift. Be willing, respond to the invitation. For presence to be without implication. I hear you. If it's boring, don't do it. Go to the movie. Go to your movie. Apparent continuity is on tap. If you touch this, meaning attention and interest has animated a kernel, an artifact of experience. If you touch this, it will touch you back. And that is the movement of apparent continuity. What's strange, not to single it out, since it's all strange, is that the generosity of apparent continuity, the instant-on inebriation of personification, shares as a companion to the same space, if you will, as unadorned attention. So both are at hand. Unadorned attention.
Relief.
And the launch of anything, everything. if we find ourselves sipping from the fountain of implication, of experiencing, then the manifestation or personification, continuity, imagination of one's life comes pouring in. Possible, let's say, might be possible to discover that presence is also unadorned, unafflicted. We take our mouth off of the tap of personification and apparent continuity. We find ourselves nourished by simplicity, free from opinion, free from relativistic accusation, maybe we spend a little time, a little quality time here, there. And also with you, Sven. the movement of discovery as experience through narrative, emotion, recognition, enjoyment or dismissive moods. Anthropomorphizes the field. Sometimes we're given misdirection. As if meditation or practice can be a means to become present. However, if presence already is, then one would be taking a long, circuitous, labyrinthian route back to what already is. But if you simply don't distort it in the first place, then no meditation is needed, no vehicle is needed, because the hallucination of being anywhere other than presence itself doesn't arise. If we're medicating our confusion or attempting to redirect confusion, more than likely will end up remaining in the loop under the influence of that confusion. Mind is very seductive. Its favorite game is to tell you, meaning to tell itself, that there's something that it needs to do something about. That is the, you could say, the seed of personification. Consciousness has found an object, an event, a circumstance, a sensation, threat of any kind, and now there's something that you need to do something about. Then the guru comes along and says, well, maybe you'd be better off becoming present. It may take a little maturity, a little study, let's say, a little cushion time to begin to appreciate the, noumenal essence of non-duality. Sorry, I said that. I'll say it again. The noumenal essence of non-duality is this here now, this here now. But you're not going to find this very easily here. You can kiss that goodbye, and now there's no such thing. So some other magical capacity, a magical capacity, a non-dual, non-conceiving, non acquisitive capacity. Discovers self-essence, being, and is able then with glee to discard the spiritual instructions or spiritual practices that start with delusion and then foolishly attempt to mitigate that delusion. Now, we could say that this discovery, which is not easy to articulate because language and words suggest, right, an object and an implication and a thing and, you know, temporal continuity, but there is none of that. Yes, thought upon thought upon thought. So prior to launch, prior to the being in receipt of or insisting upon or subscribing to or signing up for, right, personification, There's whatever this is, and fuck if I know what it is. I don't. So this, we're going to refer to it as prior to, can't possibly be prior to, because the holism of whatever present experience is, unadorned is on tap, and right, personification is on tap concomitantly. So we can kind of say prior to, but well, we know we're lying. And yes, as we get a feel for it, and we can use language, let's say more playfully, we can absolutely, abiding is prior to. With the cessation of conceiving, which is why not present, here we are, whatever the fuck where is, having a one-sided verbal and texted conversation. Even in the midst of the communication medium, we needn't be under the influence of conceiving. The dichotomous mind, the mind of personification, accuses and insists on true, right? Because of its opposite. So it relies on, you know, contentious, argumentative presumption to solicit or communicate what might be true or untrue. And that is the business of conceiving. Why not? But the clarified mind does not rely upon conceiving. does not personify and then convince itself of what it needs to do about whatever it finds to be unpleasant. This doesn't mean, you know, you should be able to walk on water. You're probably better off drowning anyway. You know, when we fetishize saints and avadhuts, stream entrance and the like, you know, we expect these mutants to have, you know, be in possession of miraculous powers, bilocation, and loaves and fishes, on and on and on and on. And then we are attracted to these, you know, not to the freedom itself. We're not attracted to the freedom itself. We're attracted to the symptoms and physics bending demonstrations of the mutant. The world is in whatever chaos it may be in. Thanks to our agreements and disagreements and blind loyalty to mutantism. And of course the socio-political abuse of religious messaging throughout the ages. The hate speech of we, they. The evangelicalism of political discourse. Chauvinistic paternalism. Consumes the biosphere. Wouldn't it be lovely? Wouldn't it be strange? To see that there's nothing in it for you. A gift of existential relaxation, a gift of existential innocence, so deep and so simply present. That there's nothing in it for us. This isn't about anything. To be released from the influence of others, the knowledge. Their spiritual and religious hubris. The fascistic narrative of political sphere. Petty superstitions. And loyalties of incarcerated being. To be able to discover in an innate intelligence that does not suffer the apparition of personification. I think those Dzogchen boys and girls refer to it as the great perfection. Yes, thank you. Appreciate everyone being here this evening. Your enthusiasm. I hope you had as much fun as I did. We'll see you at the next one.